Calling all explorers, if that's you, welcome to the show. This is the only place where we speed around the universe. We search out all those secrets lurking. Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. This is the speediest show in the universe. We'll get you all around the place in about half an hour. And this week, we've got one of our favourite geniuses on answering your questions. It's Marshall Brain, who runs How Stuff Works, one of the smartest websites around. And we're talking all about what powers things for you every day.
You're taking a chemical reaction and you're using it to create electricity. So you want that in a package that you can carry around with you. And usually that involves some kind of liquid or paste or something. So the package is just keeping it all together.
And we're back searching for the best science around. This week, it's all about why we can recognize faces.
We have to be able to identify people. So we learn new faces. We learn to recognize people. We couldn't have a social life. We couldn't function in the world very easily if we couldn't identify those that we know, family and friends.
And you can hear about one of the most terrifying, formidable predators in the ocean. It's like something out of Doctor Who, seriously. Stick around for a brand new Fun Kids Science Weekly. And we'll start things off with your science in the news. This is very sweet. Mini rope bridges have been installed in one of England's ancient forests to help hazel dormice travel safely between treetops. Two 20-metre long bridges have been built over a track in the Forest of Dean, and these bridges look like something that you might do on an adventure assault course. You see, dormice habitats have become pretty decimated and completely disconnected from each other because ash trees, where they would live, how they would travel, got diseased, so they had to be removed. So experts, the people that work in these forests, have made these stunning rope bridges to help little dormice feel safe and get around. Brilliant story. You see, we do work hard for the creatures that we live near. Also, scientists have discovered the cause of the brightest burst of light ever recorded. They spotted it in 2022 from a galaxy 2.4 billion light years away. It was 7 meters long, and it was so powerful, it was off the scale. It completely overwhelmed the instruments that detect these things. It was 100 times brighter than anything seen before. It's nicknamed the boat, the brightest of all time. It let out extremely strong gamma rays, high bursts of energy. We actually spoke about those in our Dangerous Dan just a few weeks ago. And experts think that the cause was because of an exploding star right in the middle. And it's made us ask even more questions about the universe. You see, experts, we're always thinking about our place in the universe. And our final story this week, the White House over in America wants the space agency NASA to develop a new time zone for the moon called Coordinated Lunar Time, LTC. Let's find out more with Catherine Haymans, the Astronomer Royal for Scotland with the Royal Observatory Edinburgh. Huge title, Catherine. We're so honoured to have you on. Just tell us, what time is the moon on now?
Well, there is no defined time for the moon at the moment. Different visitors who go to the moon, there are probes and astronauts. Well, there haven't been any astronauts for quite a while, but they usually use the same time as planet Earth. But there's this strange thing in our universe, which means that time doesn't tick at the same speed everywhere. Dan, have you seen the movie Lightyear? It's a Pixar movie with Buzz Lightyear in it, and he's marooned on a planet far away and they're trying to get home.
Yes, the Buzz Lightyear origin story. I've seen it.
You've seen it, great. Yeah. He goes in the rocket ship and he's testing different ways to get home. And each time he goes off on a test, it feels like he's only away for minutes. But when he comes back, everyone's aged and they keep getting older and older during the movie. I'm going to give away the punchline for people who haven't seen it. And he hardly ages. And that's not science fiction. They didn't make that up for the movie. That would be what actually happened because time is not absolute, which is a really strange thing. It changes depending on how fast you're moving and where you are in the universe, which is really weird to get your head around. But that's a sort of just a fundamental fact of how physics and the universe works.
Now, I could understand, Catherine, how that would affect us and we see the impacts because we would age at a different rate. But there aren't regularly humans on the moon. How do we know that time is going at a different pace there if we're not really there to be able to see the effects?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, Dan. So this is a sort of a theoretical prediction from physics. All the tests that we've done show that it would be true. In the Buzz Lightyear movie, it's quite exaggerated. And actually, the time difference on the moon is hardly any different from Earth. If you took a clock from Earth and you took it up to the moon and you waited 50 years, then that clock would be running just 1 second faster. So, or we can put it in terms of identical twins. If you've got identical twins and one goes and lives on the moon for 50 years, then that twin will be 1 second older than the twin on Earth. So it's a very, very small time difference, but it's enough to cause real problems for space travel and space exploration. And NASA's got this grand plan to get astronauts back on the moon again, which I'm really excited about. By the end of 2026, so that's 2 years' time, there are going to be humans walking around on the moon again. That the first woman will be landing on the moon, the first person of colour. It's going to be very exciting. And there's lots of different countries wanting to get to the moon and future plans for when your listeners are grown up. The plan is that there will be people living on the moon. And so these very small time differences are going to matter, which is why we need to define what the time is on the moon.
You say it's 1 second for every 50 years, which... you say it's also important. Now, that's over such a long time scale that it's hard to really understand how that could have an impact. Why do NASA think this is worth doing? What could go wrong if we don't account for that second?
Yeah, so you'd be surprised how important it is to know the time extremely accurately. So this is particularly if you're traveling sort of through space, maybe you're in an orbit going around the moon. So the plan is that there'll be a lunar orbiter going around the moon, which the astronauts live on, and they go up and down to do their exploration on the moon. That's the plan. So, Dan, if you and I were going to meet for coffee, we'd maybe say we'll meet at the coffee bar at 2 o'clock. And if I'm a bit late, that doesn't matter because the coffee bar's still there. But in space, it's very hard to define where you are if you don't know what the time is. So the way people define where they are is they send a signal to something that's stationary, like the coffee bar, and see how long it takes to come back. So the accurate time is incredibly important if you're in space. And if you've got different countries who are using different times, then there's the potential for all sorts of catastrophes to happen if we get lots of people up on the moon. And so that's why the White House wants this universal time to be defined. But here's something funny, Dan. The European Space Agency called for this over a year ago. So actually, the White House is playing catch up here.
We will have to wait and see. Catherine Haymans, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much to you, Catherine, for coming on. Imagine that. The moon having its own time zone. I wonder if they'll have to change it with like we do here a couple of times of the year, right? Depending on the sun and how much light we want to get. I wonder if they'll have daylight savings time on the moon. Thank you very much. Right, let's get to some of your questions then. If you have anything sciencey that you want answered on the show, make sure you let me know. The best way, I would love to hear you send a voice note to me on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. Got a brilliant one of those in a second. First up, it's a message that's been sent to me by Edith Allen, who is 10 years old, almost 11. Edith wants to know, are fireworks bad for the planet? Well, fireworks are made of different chemicals, and they look stunning when they go bang, right? But they aren't brilliant for the planet. You see, all those chemicals, they have to go somewhere. A lot of it moves into gas, which ends up back into the ground, and that's not that good. The barium or the aluminium in there isn't good for animals or humans. If it goes into the soil, animals can end up eating it, chemicals that they're not really meant to have. Also, many chemicals have perchlorates in them, which make the oxygen the firework needs to explode. But when these hit the ground, they can dissolve into water, which travels into rivers and lakes and contaminates them. Not good for our drinking water, not good for the habitat fishes live in. Also, fireworks release a fine cloud of smoke, which can harm the local air too. So fireworks aren't brilliant for the planet, but scientists have been working, and now you can buy cleaner fireworks with better alternatives in them, which aren't as harmful or polluting for the atmosphere and for our planet and everyone who lives here. So that's pretty smart, and thank you for letting us look that up, Edith. Thank you for the question. Let's get on another one then. This is a voice note being sent in from Ben. What do you got, Ben?
How do batteries work?
Ben, thank you for that question. How do batteries work? And of course, there are so many different types of batteries, right? You get the little ones that your dad might have in his watch, AAs, AAAs that you can replace, and then now huge batteries, some even power cars. Well, let's find out. We have Marshall Brain on. He's been with us before. What a guy from How Stuff Works. Marshall, thank you for being there. So, batteries, how do we start explaining how they work?
Hey, Ben, and the starting point would be that you're taking a chemical reaction and you're using it to create electricity. So you want that in a package that you can carry around with you. And usually that involves some kind of liquid or paste or something. So the package is just keeping it all together. One way to understand the simplicity of a battery is to think about the common science experiment where you make a battery out of a lemon or a potato or something like that. And with those simple batteries, you're taking a piece of zinc, usually, and a piece of copper, and you poke them into the lemon, and you can power, you know, a small digital clock or an LED or something with just that much electricity. So it's super simple in that case. And then we can go on from there.
So, well, you speak about a chemical reaction, Marshall. What is that reaction? What's happening in a battery to generate the electricity?
So in this simple lemon battery or potato battery, you have the zinc, and it is using the potato. We would say the potato is providing an electrolyte and some acid. So the zinc in that acid is giving up some electrons, and those electrons are going to form the electricity, and they're going through the LED or whatever it's powering. And it comes back to the copper, and the copper is using those electrons to turn hydrogen from the acid, hydrogen ions from the acid, into hydrogen gas. So you might, you know, if you make a potato battery, you might notice some little bubbles coming out next to the copper, which is usually, at least in the United States, it's a penny, you know, is where you get your copper from. So the penny will have little bubbles next to it. That's the hydrogen gas being formed by the electrons that are flowing through that little circuit.
Let's go bigger. Cars have batteries.
Yeah.
Is it a similar thing? Is there a liquid in them? How are they working?
So there's normal cars, like a gasoline-powered car that we've been used to for 100 years. Those have what's called a lead-acid battery in them. And in a lead-acid battery, you're taking lead and an acid and more lead, really. And one side is lead oxide, and it too will give up electrons and then flow over to the lead side of the battery. And the cool thing about a lead acid battery is it's rechargeable. So if you put electricity back in it, it'll absolutely reverse that chemical reaction and put everything back the way it was. In a lemon or potato battery, there's no way in that chemical reaction to undo it. The nice thing about the lead acid battery is that you can undo it and put everything back for about 4 years. And then the battery has gotten deformed internally to the point where you can't put things back anymore. And you have to buy a new one.
With new cars, so with e-vehicles, Teslas, that kind of thing, how different are the batteries in there?
Right. So inside most electric cars, like a Tesla, that's a lithium ion battery. And so that same idea, just a different chemistry. So now we're on our third, you know, chemical reaction. And in that case, you're taking lithium and an electrolyte or a liquid and some graphite, and you're moving lithium atoms or ions through the electrolyte into the graphite to store it. That will get you charged up, and then you move the lithium ions back to make the electricity flow. And the advantage of those is they're really lightweight compared to a lead acid battery, because lead's really heavy, and they can store a lot more power for their size. So it's a more, you know, it's more electricity in a smaller tube in that case.
Well, there you go, Ben. That is how batteries work. Marshall Brain, that's why Brain is in his name. Brilliant explanation. Thank you so much for joining us, Marshall.
Well, this has been fun.
Thank you very much to Marshall Brain for coming on the show. Marshall is one of our favourite geniuses. I love any chance to get him on to answer one of your questions. So if you have anything that you want, make sure you leave it as a voice note for us on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. And let's search through the universe then for something strange, weird, unique, often deadly, and add to our Dangerous Dan list. This week we're heading under the ocean to take a look at a creature with a silly name, but a terrifying look. You'll find the bobbit worm in the warm waters around the Indian and Pacific Oceans. It lies on the seabed, burying itself into the sand way down there. And it can grow to 3 meters long. Honestly, imagine an alien that you might have seen in Doctor Who or a movie, and this won't look too far away. It's got little like leggy things from either side of a greenish-yellow body. Its head is what is truly terrifying. It's got little colourful antenna on top of it. Those are the only things that stick out of the sand. It's also got wide, sharp jaws that look like a flower of pincers. They fan out quickly, snapping shut on any prey that's nearby. Have you ever been on holiday and you've got the arcade machines and there's that grabber, you know, which you reach down to try and pluck a toy, and it almost never works, right? The things always fall apart. Well, it looks like that, rising from the sand. And its hunting strategy is brutal. It lies in wait, quietly on the floor. And when something is near, it shoots out with astonishing speed. Its strike is so swift, so powerful, it can slice its prey in half. They're one of the best, most formidable predators under the sea. They've earned the nickname the Ocean's Assassin, which is why the bobbit worm, which is a sillier name than the Ocean's Assassin. But anyway, the bobbit worm is going straight onto our Dangerous Dan list. Now it's time on the Fun Kids Science Weekly for our weekly battle to discover what is the best science of them all. I invite on an expert every week and they try to prove why their field should come first. And today, trying to be first is faces. We've got Robin Kramer from the University of Lincoln talking all about face perception. Robin, thank you for joining us. You have 1 minute to start off talking about why face perception is awesome. In 3, 2, 1, you're away.
Pretty much everyone I know has a face, and I think that faces clearly play a role in our lives every day. With strangers, we can tell lots of things about people already, like how old they are, whether they're a man or a woman, and also we form impressions of those strangers, so how attractive we think maybe they are, even how angry or aggressive they might be. But then, perhaps more importantly, we have to be able to identify people. So we learn new faces, we learn to recognize people. We couldn't have a social life, we couldn't function in the world very easily if we couldn't identify those that we know, family and friends, and then form those sort of long-term relationships where we can trust those people, have relationships with them, eventually maybe have children with them. And so everything about our social lives is dependent on the fact that we recognize people, remember them, and then we can form those relationships.
There you go. Bang on a minute as well, Robin. Thank you so much. Now, what's interesting about this as a science is that, you know, we've had faces for hundreds of thousands of years, and us as humans, our ability to read faces has always been there. So how are you making it into a smart science? Like, what are you studying to find out what we already don't automatically know just by being around faces all the time?
Well, we think a lot of things about faces because we feel like we're experts. We all have a face. We see other people's faces. We know and recognize lots of faces. But there's still a huge amount we don't understand, mostly to do with things like, how do we learn those faces? How do we represent them inside our brain somewhere so that we can recognize someone after 5 or 10 years of not seeing them? Or how do we cope with new faces? One thing people have to do is match a stranger's face to their ID passport photo or driving license photo. Understanding how that process works and where it doesn't work is important in terms of security. And then obviously, why and how we find certain faces attractive and others not. We all have a personal sense of what we think of as attractive, but as a species, as sort of, you know, the human population, what do we find attractive and why? Why is this to some extent similar across people, but also to some extent different? So what I find attractive will be somewhat different to what everyone else finds attractive. So understanding all of those things is very different from, you know, us personally thinking, well, you know, I recognize faces, I'm very familiar with them, so I must know all there is.
In your work with face perception, what is something absolutely mind-blowing that you have learned that no one else would kind of believe that that's something you do?
One thing is that we think that we're amazing with faces because we're very good typically with the faces we know, so our friends and our family and things. But one thing that surprises people is that with strangers' faces, we're really not that good. And so, as I mentioned before, this idea of having to match people to their passport photos, if you think about photographs and how they can vary so much because we get older and we change, but also photographs in social media and things, how we smile, how we turn our heads, how we change our hairstyles, different lighting, different cameras. And so when we're faced with those sorts of things and we see a picture of someone we don't know and we have to match them, lots of mistakes can be made. And so you can show people images of new identities, new people's faces, ask them to match these photos. Are the two images the same person or two different people? And people make lots of mistakes because it's really hard. And then if you think about sort of passport photos, they're quite small, sometimes low quality, driving license photos even smaller. And so when professionals even have to match these photos to your face, they make mistakes sometimes because it's not easy. We're really good with faces, but that tends to be limited to faces we know. Unfamiliar faces, we're not actually that good.
And my last question, just throwing yourself forward like 30, 40, 50 years, when you're kind of done with your work in face perception, what's the one thing that you really want to have discovered? What's that one burning question that you want answered?
I guess the big thing is just how do we learn and become familiar and understand faces? We know somewhere in the brain this is happening, but in terms of what's going on in there, how do we build a representation of that face we know really well? Is it just by seeing them in lots of different ways? Is it over time? How do we build that representation so that we can then differentiate or tell a difference between that person and someone who looks quite like them? And how do we recognize them when their face changes over 10 or 20 years? I'd still recognize someone who I hadn't seen in that long. And so it's just that idea of, you know, we know that faces are important. We know that we learn faces. But what is it that we've learned?
Amazing. Well, it's in with a shout. It's in with a good argument of being near the top of the list. Robin Kramer from the University of Lincoln, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you think? Does Robin Kramer put a good fight for his field and why faces and studying faces should come first in the battle of the sciences? I wonder. We'll have another one on for you really shortly. Talking about recognition, thinking about how we spot faces, we can also spot fingerprints, can't we? Well, let's find out more with Technomum, one of our brilliant series. Technomum is a genius. She discovers all the exciting engineering behind loads of gadgets. And there are strange new fingerprint scanners all over the place, including in the library. And Technomum is finding out how they work.
Technomum, with the Institution of Engineering and Technology, advancing and sharing technology.
I think our head teacher must like science fiction movies. Today he told us we're getting fingerprint scanners in the library, the canteen, and for registration. Sounds pretty space age to me. Maybe the school trip will be to Mars this year.
Hang on, I'll give you the letter about it, Mum. It's in my school bag.
Wow, not surprised you lose things, Tim. That bag is like a black hole. Let's have a look. Oh, yes. It's not really that unusual. Even my laptop has a fingertip recognition scanner on it, and I've had it for 2 years. Just think, you'll never lose a library card or your dinner money again. How many library cards exactly have you lost this year?
Loads.
Not many. It does sound pretty cool, but how can my fingerprint know what books I've got, or whether I can afford my school dinner?
It's like barcodes. The fingerprint just says who you are, and a computer looks up a file all about how much money you've got for dinner, what books you're borrowing, and with registration, whether you're on time or late. Did you make it on time this morning?
Just about. I had to run. But how does it work? Do you think it hurts?
Of course not. The first thing they do is get a picture of your fingertip. Sometimes this is done with an optical scanner, which uses technology like you'd find in a digital camera. Tiny electronic components sense the dark and light parts of the fingertips and convert them into pixels that make up the image. Other types of scanners take the image using electrical currents.
Ouch, that sounds painful.
You don't feel a thing. And the electrical current sort are much more accurate. So, they've got a picture of your fingertip, and as you know, they are something that are unique to each of us. So no one else's will be quite like yours.
So then once I'm all logged in then, I just put my finger on the pad and off I go. How did it find me again, though? There's 2,000 kids in my school. That's a lot of fingerprints.
And the computer is cleverer than all of you kids put together. Algorithms are used to work out whose fingerprint is whose.
An algorithm? What's an algorithm when it's at home?
An algorithm is like a set of rules that the computer uses to check the image. Sometimes it'll perform a calculation using the distances between the parts of the pattern and compare the results to the results on file. Other types of algorithms look at particular areas and match them against all the same area on the library of images. Tilly, turn it down! That sister of yours is as bad as you with volume controls. Anyway, Tim, it all happens in a flash.
Hey, that reminds me of something at Dylan's house. His game console can tell who you are by scanning your face. Is that the same technology?
Yup, the scanner uses algorithms in the same way. Sometimes it does a calculation using points on your face. Other times it analyses one little piece. You get facial recognition software in all sorts of things. Games, cameras, websites where you upload photos, even at airports.
It's a bit weird to think of this information about me all being in the computer somewhere.
I know what you mean, Tim. Technology does get into every part of our lives these days. But there are rules about what sort of information can be held about you, especially biometric data. That's things like your fingerprints. And don't you think that technology makes life easier? After all, you can't lose your fingertips, can you?
That would be pretty hard.
Although I am particularly good at losing things, so you never know.
Talking of fingertips, they look pretty mucky from where I'm standing. Go and give them a wash before tea.
Oh, Mum, they're fine.
Don't give me that. It looks like you've been foraging in the flower beds.
Technomum, with the Institution of Engineering and Technology, advancing and sharing technology.
And that's it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for exploring the universe with me. If you've got a question that you want answered next week on the show, make sure you leave it as a voice note on the free Fun Kids app or at funkidslive.com. You heard from Technomum as well. We've got loads more episodes from her and brilliant series that you can get involved in whenever you fancy on Google, Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your shows. They're on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com too. And Fun Kids, we're a children's radio station from the UK. Listen all over the country on our app, on our website, and if you've got a smart speaker, wake it up and ask it to play Fun Kids.